Welcome to this Worldview podcast for Engelsberg Ideas and the latest in our series of reflections on war. I'm Adam Bolton, and in this episode, I'm going to be talking to two extremely distinguished historians about what historic lessons, if any, can be learnt from the current war in Ukraine. They are Professor Margaret Macmillan, who's based at St Anthony's College, Oxford. She's also the Engelsberg Chair in History and International Affairs at LSE Ideas. And Professor Andrew Roberts, currently the Roger and Martha Metz Visiting Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and Visiting Professor at the War Studies Department of King's College, London. He's the biographer of Napoleon, Churchill and currently George III. I began by asking Margaret Macmillan about her recent New Statesman article in which she suggested we should be preparing for World War III. Is it as bad as that?
Well, I don't want to write things like that, but I'm aware, and I'm sure Andrew and you are aware too, of how often wars can start by accident and how they become so rapidly uncontrollable. I mean, no one knows where this war is going to go, whether it will draw in more players. And that's what worries me. You know, I don't write these sorts of things with any pleasure whatsoever. But given the role of accidents, coincidence, or the role of those who are prepared to go to great lengths to win, and I think Putin, it so far seems to be prepared to go to considerable lengths to win, we can't rule out a wider conflict. And that's what worries me.
And do you feel that the response of the Western allies of NATO and others has been sufficiently cautious, or has it been too cautious?
It's so hard to judge. I mean, I think it has been sufficiently cautious, and I think they are very right to be worried about what might happen next. I mean, there's always the danger of escalation, and the weapons now, of course, are terrifying. You know, we've got used to the idea of peace after the end of the Cold War, but the nuclear arsenals are still there. They've been improved upon. The other sorts of weapons are still there, and they're being improved upon, and we know that there's been research done on biological and chemical weapons, certainly in Russia. And there's always the danger that if people feel they're going to lose, or if they feel that they've, you know, got nothing to lose, that they will use such weapons. And so I think NATO and the Western powers generally have been cautious. I think they're right to be cautious. But I think they are also right not to give up on Ukraine. I mean, I think if Putin gets away with this, if President Putin gets away with this, he will try more. I mean, he won't leave the rest of Ukraine alone, given his previous record. He probably won't leave Moldova alone. He probably won't leave the Baltic states alone. And then, of course, there's a demonstration effect. Others will be tempted to follow his precedent. I mean, you know, if once you start looking at borders in the world or who could claim whatever piece of territory, the possibilities are very large indeed for future conflicts.
Andrew Roberts, how worried are you about escalation into something looking like a world war?
I think it is one of those classic moments where you have to work out if somebody's learnt from history or not. And it strikes me that NATO has learnt from history, that they've stepped back from a number of things they could have done, the classic example being the 28 MiG-29s that didn't in the end go to Ukraine, and the way in which Western leaders have tiptoed almost when it comes to infuriating President Putin. However, I don't think President Putin has learnt the lessons of history here at all. I think that his saber-rattling, his references to nuclear war and various other things that he and other members of his cabinet, like Medvedev, have said, are clearly in no way trying to damp down the dangers of escalation. I also agree so much with what Margaret said about the Baltic states, because I've read that 6,500-word essay that he wrote in the July of 2021, and there are no fewer than 17 references to Lithuania, and there are other references to Estonia, and I think, really, this is very worrying, because if he was somehow to get away with this, if he wasn't stopped or defeated, or I don't mean punished in a sort of geostrategic way, but I mean the actual attack needs to be punished in a military way, I think that we could well see a further escalation, yes. And Moldova, when Margaret mentioned Moldova, I mean, that seems to be very much on the cards.
But the worry is that the Ukrainians, President Zelensky, are already saying, well, the help we've had is too little too late. It's not going to stop Russia. And unless Russia is pushed back, even if there is a peace, Andrew, can we just simply see Putin and Russia biding its time and then trying again?
Yes, of course we can, absolutely. And that would be disastrous. It would be tragic. And also, I think another, just to pick up on something else that Margaret said that I thought was very wise, is that you've got the in the Far East with Taiwan and China, you've got other actors, I would say bad actors, looking at this very closely and seeing, can we get away with it ourselves?
So that begs the question, is too little too late enough? I mean, should we be doing more?
Well, we're doing quite a lot, actually, the British at least. The Americans have just passed 33 billion military package for Ukraine, which is pretty substantial. We're, both of us are sending really impressive lethal weaponry there. The problem, it strikes me, is when you promise something to Ukraine, and they therefore will make tactical plans regarding those promises, and then don't deliver, which is, seems that is what you're seeing from France and Germany.
Now, I heard a Ukrainian strategist this week saying that, Margaret, the possibility is there could be a turn in the war in August, once this equipment that's coming from Britain and the United States and others is in the theatre.
Yeah, I think if the Ukrainians can hang on until the autumn, they will have a very good chance, I think, of regrouping during the winter and being in much stronger shape by next spring, provided the equipment comes. And of course, they have the great advantage over the Russians of fighting on their home territory, fighting for their homes. I mean, clearly morale has been extremely important in this. I mean, morale is no good without the weapons, but the Ukrainians, I think, have demonstrated a capacity to fight, which the Russians haven't. And, you know, so far as anyone can tell, Putin has probably lost about half his armed forces. He's probably lost about half his army. He's lost a great deal of equipment. And Russia is not, I think, going to be able to make up that quickly enough. And the Ukrainians have shown themselves to be very adaptable. I mean, the Ukrainians have shown themselves to be very quick at being trained with new weapons. I think there were some, I forget, armored personnel vehicles, that I think it was, that came in from the British, and the British thought it would take them at least 2 weeks to get to know how to use them. And it took them 2 days. And so I think, you know, if the Ukrainians can get the equipment and if they can continue the fight and continue on until things will presumably come to some sort of stasis in the winter, then I think they will have a very good chance. It depends a lot on what sort of equipment they keep on getting. And Andrew's absolutely right. I mean, the British and the Americans have done a lot. The Germans, well, the Chancellor made this great promise at the beginning, and then they've been very slow to deliver. But it does seem as if public opinion in Germany is increasingly in favor, and the vice chancellor from the Green Party is increasingly in favor of upping Germany's support. And so as long as the support can keep coming in, you know, it's hard to predict, but I would think the Ukrainians do, in fact, have a good chance.
And of course, so long as we as a democracy don't start to just get Ukraine fatigue.
Which is what Boris Johnson's been talking about.
Well, and it does happen, you know, this in warfare, obviously it does, that it just essentially becomes boring for people who aren't directly involved in it. And therefore, the impetus sort of drops off. That's another worry. I don't think it's a key worry right now, but say this war carries on for 3 or 4 years, especially at a time when people have got their cost of living crisis here in Britain, people might well start saying, look, should we be spending this amount of money fighting for essentially for freedom? But
Andrew, one of the things that surprised me about this war, and perhaps you could put this in context with other invaders, Napoleon and others, is smashing to smithereens the country which you're supposedly, or the territory which you're supposedly trying to take and incorporate in your society.
Yes, that's right. And you saw that, of course, with Napoleon and the invasion of Russia, where appalling devastation took place. I think another aspect, though, that's interesting, I'm glad you mentioned Napoleon, is this whole question of morale, which Margaret mentioned earlier, which is so key to this, because although there are 144 million Russians and only 44 million Ukrainians, actually the morale of the Ukrainians is so much higher and three times higher than it is the Russians. You're seeing people in Ukraine actually cheating, lying about their ages in order to get onto the military register and fight.
As we saw here in
1914. Tragically, in many senses, obviously, but nonetheless, it does show a tremendously high morale. At the same time, you're seeing desertions on the Russian side and certain amount of fragging going on where you actually attack your own officers. There's been talk about people destroying the petrol tanks of their own armoured personnel carriers and so on. So, I mean, this is a classic, all three of those things are classic examples of deteriorating morale.
And have we seen it before? Did we see it on the Russian side in 1812?
Fragging, of course, you saw in Vietnam to a degree, but in 1812, no. The morale, it was extraordinary how the morale of the French army kept up, but that was largely because they had been fighting together as a unified force for 20 years up to the invasion of 1812. And so it was a tremendously homogenous unit. Whereas, of course, this Russian army, unless you were actually serving in Georgia or Syria, you haven't been fighting that. And especially, of course, these young conscripts that they're sending in. This is another absolutely central, I'd be interested to hear if Margaret agrees with this, a central factor of the evolution of warfare since 1945 is that we see again and again that you shouldn't be sending essentially untrained 19-year-olds into battle because they aren't very good at it, they do get low morale, they behave abominably in the way that the Russians have done, especially outside Kyiv, as we saw last month. And, you know, they're the wrong kind of soldiers to send into any kind of war.
Well, I gather also they're sending them in, I agree with Andrew, they're sending them more and more with less and less training. And I've also noticed, I mean, one of the things I think that we'll tell here is the domestic situation and how soon and how much the war begins to weigh on Russia. But it is very obvious, I think, and really stands out, that Putin has not moved to conscript people in either of the big cities of St. Petersburg or Moscow. And I think he is rightly afraid of what the public reaction would be. I mean, a lot of the conscripts are coming from the Far East. And I gather they're also being paid. Effectively, they're being told that money will be paid to their families if they volunteer. Well, they've also been getting volunteers from the Far East, which means that their morale is not going to be all that high. And I think if we're remembering history, I think the Russian leadership should be remembering what happened in the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905, which was a war that was fought with great incompetence by the Russian forces, making many, I think, of the same mistakes that they're making today, assuming they'd have an easy victory over the Japanese, not paying proper attention to logistics, to morale, to preparation, and with troops who weren't adequately trained for what they're expected to do, and with a navy that was, well, first of all, half it was bottled up and the other half sailed around the world and was sunk. And it led to a revolution in Russia and very nearly toppled the Tsarist regime in 1905 and 1906. And I think the Russians should also be remembering what happened in their war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, when increasingly the losses in Afghanistan began to have an impact on Russian society and helped to undermine the last days of the old Soviet regime.
And of course, the United States and the United Kingdom have not prevailed in their more recent wars of invasion in terms of turning the countries and they conquered into allies.
Yeah, you know, I think part of the trouble is you go in expecting, I think great powers fall into this particularly. I mean, you look at the numbers and you look at the size. And as Andrew said, Russia has far more people than Ukraine does. And I think the Russians made a calculation as we're so big and so powerful that, you know, Ukraine won't have a chance against us. And I think that's very much what the British and Americans thought in Iraq. It's very much what the Americans thought in Vietnam, that the other side would simply recognize that they were so outnumbered and so outweighed in military equipment, they wouldn't be able to fight. And I think that proved to be a very costly mistake. And I think it also shows the difficulties, those earlier wars show the difficulties of carrying on wars that are increasingly unpopular at home. Now, a dictatorship may be able to last a bit longer in such wars, but even then, they begin to get undermined by what happens.
And also, democracies tend to do better in wars because they aren't so scared of the truth. And so when a totalitarian power will go out of its way to make sure that the people don't know the actual truth of what's going on, the classic example, of course, in recent months being this whole idea of calling it a special operation, military operation, rather than a war. And when the truth seeps out, as it does, as it tends to do, it becomes all the more powerful when it can be directed against the totalitarian.
Let's talk about leadership and the personalities in this. And a very simple question, Margaret. I mean, is this Putin's war in the sense that if there was another Russian leader, it wouldn't have happened?
I think it is Putin's war. You know, he has around him people who are hardliners who he, of course, has chosen for their views and who will reflect what the leader wants them to say. But I suspect any other leader probably would not have taken this gamble or would have found some way by now of trying to wind it down. But if you look at what Putin has been saying and doing, I mean, I think we have to take his ideas very seriously. And I think Andrew's absolutely right to mention the essay that he wrote, which is, I mean, I don't recommend going off to read it because it's rambling and it's very bad history. But it reflects, I think, his view of the world. And he's reiterated this both before and afterwards, that Russia was once this great empire. He compares himself to Peter the Great. He compares himself to Stalin. He wants to recover the territory that he thought that was lost from that period. And I think he was determined to make this war. And in that essay, he talks about the spiritual unity of the Russians and Ukrainians. We're hearing less about that today because the Ukrainians don't seem to want to be spiritually united with Putin's Russia. And the great irony, of course, is he's talking about, you know, Kyiv and how it's the center of Kyiv and Rus and it's, you know, the spiritual home of Orthodoxy as he's busily destroying it.
I agree. I think it's very important to listen to dictators, even though you assume that a lot of what they're saying is perhaps unhinged, but also is directed to their own domestic audiences and so on. But nonetheless, we have over the years very often ignored the statements of our enemies to our peril. We should have listened much more carefully to Hitler in January 1939 when he talked about the annihilation of the Jewish race in Europe, for example, when Stalin spoke in the mid-1930s about foreign affairs and how he would welcome a war, an imperialist war between the capitalist powers and so on. You know, actually, probably also we should listen to the Iranian leaders today and what they claim that they want to do to Israel. Again and again, we tend to think that they're all just sort of exaggerating for effect. But sometimes, including those three examples I've just given you, they might actually just have been absolutely honest about their intentions.
It is late period Putin, though, isn't it? I mean,
one hopes so.
No, but in the sense that you can remember a time when Putin was seen as someone who we could work with, that George Bush looked into his eyes and felt he could trust him and all that. And he was saying very different things 10 years ago.
He was, but he was also always, right from the beginning, remember the Kursk submarine where he allowed all those Russian sailors who an American rescue mission might have possibly been able to save. He preferred to have them all die than have Americans look inside a Russian nuclear submarine. He has been ruthless, unbelievably ruthless. The Chechen War also was a long time ago now, and the ruthlessness with which he fought with that, including possibly a false flag bombing of a Russian apartment block, shows that this man was and always has been a totally ruthless man.
Did we misread him, Margaret Milne?
Yes, and we've done it before, and it's a natural human thing. I mean, you want to believe that those you're dealing with on the other side share your views, and you want to believe that they will be persuaded by what you're saying. You want to believe you can work with them. I remember years ago in Toronto, Putin came as he'd just become president, I think, at the end of the 1990s, and he came, gave a talk to, you know, a big sort of lunch, and we all said, oh, isn't that wonderful? You know, he's so reasonable, and he wants to work with the West, and he may have even meant some of it, because I think there's the, who knows, but there's the other thing that I think happens with dictators, and it's the fatal flaw in all their power and in the offices they hold, is that they get more and more isolated and more convinced that they're right. And it becomes more and more difficult for people to disagree with them or tell them they're wrong. I mean, if you look at the people who came to surround Stalin, they depended on him. And they wouldn't tell him when they thought he was wrong because it was literally as much as their lives were worth. And I doubt very much today if there's anyone very much in the inner circle in Russia who's saying, by the way, Vladimir, we think you've made a bit of a mistake here and let's see how we can get out of it. I mean, you would not last for very long if you said things like that. But I think there's this sort of madness that overtakes dictators because of the circumstances in which they live, where everyone's always agreeing with them.
Yes, that's right. I think there's a lot to be said for the old medieval court system where you had a sort of licensed naysayer in the fool. You know, the fool, the clown, would actually say something that's completely different from everybody else and occasionally write. And the king didn't have the license to chop off his head. This is another example, I think, of how democracies, although they're not so good at starting wars, they are better at winning them, because you have people who, especially chiefs of staff, who can refuse to go along with things. They can completely disagree with leaders' strategic thoughts. They can, as Alan Brooke did in the Second World War, sit across the table from Winston Churchill, breaking pencils in half, saying, no, I disagree with you, Prime Minister. Minister. And ultimately, if they stick together, the Chiefs of Staff are able to pursue a strategy that is not the one that the leader wants. And that has proved to be tremendously useful in democracies, and it just does not exist in dictatorships.
Although we have seen, I mean, obviously Navalny, but thanks to the internet and quite wide protest in civil society in Russia, haven't we? I mean, more than we saw in Nazi Germany.
Yeah, but
example.
Where is Navalny? He's locked up in jail. He might be there for the rest of his life. It's, you know, and he survived an assassination attempt. I don't think that's a too strong an argument, frankly, for Russia not being a totalitarian dictatorship.
And Margaret McMillan, what have you made of Volodymyr Zelensky, his leadership? How important has that been in this war still going on?
I think it's hugely important. And I think probably like most people, you know, when the war started, I thought, well, here is someone who his approval ratings were down about 25%. He'd made a name as a comedian. I watched the YouTube videos of him doing the Ukrainian equivalent of Strictly Come Dancing. And he looked very nice in his flowered shirt and danced beautifully. But no, I mean, I just thought this is a bit of a joke, isn't it? And poor man, he's completely out of his depth. Well, I was so wrong. I mean, he's one of these people who has risen to the occasion. And in fact, when you look at his career, he wasn't just a comedian, he wasn't just an interactive dancer. I mean, he was someone who ran his own company, who had to bring people together, who had to work with people, probably had to work with a lot of temperaments, I imagine, in the acting world. And he is an extraordinary communicator. I mean, what he has done, and it's both demonstration effect. I mean, the fact that he wouldn't leave, he wouldn't go to safety. You know, I'm trying to remember that phrase when he
ammunition
said...
Ammunition, not a ride.
Yes, ammunition, not a ride. It was, you know, it was so brilliant. And he is so good at communicating. And if you look at the... I mean, every day he's talking to a different parliament or to a different university group or to a different group. But he's also spoken to the Ukrainian people. I mean, he had what Winston Churchill had, that ability to speak to people and make them think, you know, we're in it together and we're going to come through. So I think he's been absolutely critical. I think with a different sort of leader, it's very difficult to predict what would have happened. I mean, a lot of people must have said when the Russian invasion started, we don't have a hope. Let's save something. And it looks like the Russians probably had, it's Yanushenko, I think, who's been living in Moscow. They probably, you know, I suspect they probably had him in their baggage train ready to pop him up into a government. I mean, it's an old, old technique. But Zelensky, I think, has made a huge difference and continues to make a difference.
I agree. And I think it's very rare that actually the word Churchillian can be used as an adjective for leadership. But here, absolutely, undoubtedly, certainly, he is a Churchillian leader. He, and of course, quoted or at least paraphrased Churchill a great deal in his speech to the House of Commons, or Houses of Parliament, when he talked, we shall fight in the forest, we shall fight in the streets and so on. That is a classic, straightforward paraphrase. And it went down tremendously well. And as Margaret says, you know, there's hardly a great meeting that takes place. We've had the G7 that he spoke to and Glastonbury. He is, as Margaret says, he's a tremendous performer, and he is getting his message across in an open and democratic way, which the Russians simply can't deal with. They don't know how to react to this. You know, to accuse him of being a fascist when he's Jewish is, of course, one of the classic sort of disinformation failures of Russian propaganda.
Yeah. And even the visual images, you know, the man that Navalny calls grandpa and says, you know, Putin, he's cowering in his bunker. And you see this sort of old, rather pale Putin clearly wearing sort of armored vest whenever he goes out and looking sort of, you know, slightly, you know, sitting at the end of that ludicrously long table.
Puffy and ill, he looks.
Puffy and ill. And then you see Zelensky, who very carefully doesn't wear suits. He wears just an average T-shirt that they wear in the Ukrainian army, and who speaks in a language that, you know, I don't speak Ukrainian, but every Ukrainian can listen to him and say, "This, yes, this is ours." He just looks so different.
I mean, he's doing daily broadcasts to his own people. I can't remember any other leader doing that or even being able to do it.
No, Churchill did broadcast a lot, but certainly not daily, no.
Now, what about the response in this country? Anything Churchillian, do you think, Andrew Roberts, about Boris Johnson?
Yes, I think that the fact that he was the first person to send lethal weaponry, he was the first leader, even before the Americans, to do that. I think the fact that he's...
was that him or was that Ben Wallace, do you think?
That was the British government, that he's the Prime Minister.
Sure.
It certainly didn't happen without his say-so, Adam, I think you'll find. And I also think that the way in which he stuck to it and the way in which he's gone there and obviously created a personal relationship with Zelensky and so on. I think these are all very, very good signs.
Margaret Milne.
Yes, I have to agree. And I'm not a great fan of this particular prime minister or indeed of this particular government. But I think on this, they've been absolutely right. I think sometimes I find the rhetoric coming from the foreign secretary and the defense secretary a bit much. I mean, they seem to be encouraging the Ukrainians to fight to the last Ukrainian. And I think a bit of restraint and a bit of respect for what the Ukrainians are going through would actually sound better.
I have to say, I have wondered, in spite of the claims that are made for the Prime Minister's leadership, with the exception of Jeremy Corbyn, I can't think of a recent Prime Minister who wouldn't have probably behaved in the same way.
I wonder whether they'd have all flung themselves into it quite as enthusiastically as Boris has done. Boris does have a historical sense, and I think he has spotted very well quite how literally evil President Putin is.
And what do you make, Margaret, of the response of President Macron and Chancellor Scholz and the other Europeans?
Well, it depends on, doesn't it? I mean, wishy-washy, I think. Well, with Macron, he had an election to fight. And he also, I think, has this long-standing French desire. He's very much part of that tradition of France should be the arbiter of the continent of Europe. France has a particular relationship with Russia. We've had it, you know, apart from minor things like Napoleon's invasion, but you have had a long relationship in the 19th century. They were allies in the First World War. And I think there has been this feeling, perhaps illusion at times, on the part of the French that they can speak to the Russians when others can't. I myself think Macron, President Macron, went too far in trying to talk to Putin when it was quite clear there was no point in talking to him. I mean, what's the point of having a two-hour conversation when it's quite clear that Putin's troops are continuing to advance and continuing to do awful things? And as far as Chancellor Scholz goes, he made that speech at the beginning, which I think stunned people. They thought Germany has suddenly changed its foreign policy, you know, that we're going to give all help to Ukraine. And then he seems to have pulled back. But my impression is that he's getting pressure in, I think I mentioned this earlier, within Germany.
As you say, and you also mentioned the Green Party, which is very interesting, that they are quite aggressive towards Russia.
Yeah, the Greens are interesting. Well, I was talking to someone the other day who knows German politics much better than me, and he said that the Greens have really split into the idealists who go on worrying about, vegan food, he said rather unkindly, and hemp sandals, and the realists who understand that if you want to get into power, you have to be able to compromise, and you have to want to exercise power. And that is what the vice chancellor represents, as a realist among the Green Party. And, of course, as far as getting Germany off Russian oil and gas, that's something they'd approve of anyway and have been pushing for. So, no, it is interesting. And I think Germany is going to be key here. And I think the Germans have to be reflecting. If Russia continues to expand, I mean, if you start looking at what Russia might want to claim, it would be part of Poland as well, Lithuania. I mean, this is getting closer and closer to Germany. I mean, you know, it's one thing for Americans to get involved, but the Germans are close enough to it that it really could be a direct threat to them.
I think with regard to President Macron, of course, he was up against Marine Le Pen, who is the most publicly pro-Putin politician in certainly French politics, probably European politics. So in a sense, all those 17 meetings that he had with Putin were a domestic as well as an international action. But the thing that really got me was when he went to Kyiv and suddenly discovered that there had been atrocities in Irpin and Bucha. And he said, we have discovered terrible atrocities, literally 3 weeks after those towns had been liberated, where the most monstrous atrocities had been discovered and were already subject to the International Criminal Court. I mean, that it takes a French president to come out with something quite
very short, and he's got black hair. Is he in any way Napoleonic, do you think?
No, I don't think he is.
It was interesting listening, being in France recently, that I get the impression that continental European populations actually view this rather differently from the way we do in this country, that they sort of more resigned to this sort of conflict in Russia and feel less threatened by it, which is surprising given history.
And also given geography, the fact they're much closer. And you see this in particular in Italy, which already has tremendous fatigue and has a large part of the population, something approaching 40%, that don't think that Putin should be resisted in Ukraine, at least with Italian help. So, yes, I'm afraid it is a growing phenomenon.
Margaret Milne, what about the leader of the free world, as he's sometimes called, the United States president?
Well, on this, he's been, I think, very strong. And his Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, I think, have been very strong. And the United States has, I think, shown that it can lead. I keep on thinking what would have happened if Trump had been reelected, and the story might have been very different. There are far too many, particularly in the sort of undergrowth of the Republican Party, who think Putin is a real man, you know, a real, really strong guy who really shows how to use power. I mean, Trump himself has said things like that. And so I think, you know, from the point of view...
He described Putin as a genius, I think, at one point.
He's described Putin as a genius at one point. And there's sort of an admiration for what's seen as the macho Putin. I mean, Tucker Carlson, you know, I think admires Putin. I mean, this is worrying. And if, with a different administration, particularly one headed by Trump, I don't think the aid would have been forthcoming. What will happen in the next presidential elections, or what will happen in the midterm elections this November, I think will be interesting. But so far, so good. And what is interesting, I think, also is that there's been a rethinking, I think, among Western countries. And West doesn't mean geography. It hasn't meant it for a long time. It means countries with similar values and attitudes. So it includes Japan, it includes Australia, it includes a lot of the countries of the Americas, other Asian countries and some African countries. There's been a rethinking about what do we stand for and what do we need to defend and what are our values. And I think this is probably a good thing, because I think perhaps we had become complacent. I mean, there are lots of problems still. And I think the West needs to do a better job of explaining what it's doing to the non-committed. I'm not sure we've explained very well, for example, that if countries in Africa and the Middle East are not getting grain, it's not the fault of the West. I mean, the Russians are blaming the West for this, but it's clearly the fault of the Russians. And I think we need to talk more to the non-Western world.
I think India and Pakistan, this is a very interesting area as well, because the subcontinent, which was to all intents and purposes leaning towards the West, has actually, especially in its decision to buy huge amounts of oil from Putin...
At a reduced rate.
Yes, exactly, at a cheaper price, have shown essentially a good deal of opportunism here. And it's perfectly understandable from their point of view why they want cheap oil. Who doesn't? But nonetheless, it has profoundly undermined the global opposition. And when one looks at the United Nations and the votes in the United Nations against Putin's invasion of Ukraine, at least half of the world didn't vote to denounce it. I don't mean the world's countries. It was the majority of the world's countries, but it was in terms of the
population. Yeah.
All you need is China and India, of course, not to go along with that, and already you have tipped it. But nonetheless, it's a very worrying sign that something that, for me at least, and for a lot of people in the West, is a pretty clear, you know, black and white issue, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, is not seen like that in the subcontinent.
Although perhaps on a more optimistic angle, the undying, limitless friendship between China and Russia doesn't seem to have become a thing, does it, Margaret?
Well, no. And I think, you know, in the long run, Russia will pay a very heavy penalty for Chinese support. Russia is going to end up very much the subordinate partner in this great friendship. And that will not, I think, suit Russia's interests in the long run. I mean, they're far more Chinese than Russians, particularly in the Far East. And there are certainly people in China, in the government, who remember, and why shouldn't they, that a lot of the territory that is now Russian was taken in the 19th century, and the Chinese have never accepted some of that. And so I think the Russians will find themselves very much being dragged along in China's path. How the Chinese are thinking about it, I mean, so far they seem to still be supporting Russia, but perhaps at least they are rethinking about the use of military force in trying to annex territory. I'm thinking, of course, in particular about Taiwan. What lessons the Chinese will draw from what's happening to the Russians in Ukraine, I think, will make a difference to their policies.
I agree. And I think that if you're a Chinese strategist, if you're a People's Liberation Army general, and you're looking at what happened in Mariupol, for example, you know, where a very small group of Ukrainian fighters, utterly committed with enough food and ammunition, were able to hold out for over 2 months against the onslaught of the Russian army. You must think, do you really want to try and turn Taipei into 1,000 Mariupols? I'm sure there's a lot of profound thought going on at the moment in Beijing.
What do you think people like Orban or Erdogan or other, can we call it, autocratically inclined leaders, what are they making of this, do you think, Margaret? Is it encouraging them or discouraging them?
Well, they're caught, aren't they? And I can't help but say it serves them right. I mean, Orban has been very pro-Russian in a lot of his rhetoric. He's defied the European Union in a lot of things. He's allowed increasing illiberalism. I mean, his ludicrous notion of illiberal democracy, which basically means putting all the media under your control or the control of your cronies, seems to involve a great deal of corruption among the same sort of cronies. He may now be finding himself in a difficult position. I'm sure he thought, like a lot of people, the Russians would win easily. And I think he will find, and the Hungarians, unfortunately, will pay the price for this, he'll find that memories will persist in Europe about how Orban behaved. Erdogan, I think, is treading a very tricky line. We don't know how strong his position is at home. I mean, we know there's a lot of opposition to it. I think, you know, a number of the biggest cities in Turkey are now controlled by parties that are not his, by opposition parties. And so I think, again, he's trying to steer this very tricky line. And the trouble with sometimes in confrontations like this, as Andrew knows better than me, you get people having to choose sides. I mean, you can't just sit on the sidelines and say, well, you know, we go this way and that when both sides are to blame.
But do you have to choose values as well? I mean, that's really the issue, isn't it?
Yeah, you have to choose values. And Orban and Erdogan are being stuck. And I think they're being called out on it. And I think Modi in India is too, as he should be.
I think you're absolutely right about Erdogan. I think there are a couple of things that have to be said about Orban first, and that is that some 85 to 90% of all of Hungary's energy comes from Russia. And so the knowledge that if Putin wanted to, he could switch that off. And if he did, you would find Hungarians, especially over this coming winter, starting to freeze to death. You also have a big problem, of course, with the Transcarpathians in Ukraine. You have a large Hungarian population in Transcarpathia who would be, if Putin were ultimately successful and were to take over the whole of Ukraine, under Russian control. I think the fact that Orban's just won this general election convincingly against every single other party in the opposition shows that the Hungarian people are not yet ready to punish him in the way that I think Margaret would like them to.
Well, you're a nicer person than I am, Andrew.
I don't think that's true for a moment, Margaret.
We've seen the European Union suggest that Ukraine, whatever that is, can become a member of the European Union. Do you think that's ever going to happen, Andrew?
No. I'm afraid I think you have to be tremendously utopian to think that what Scholz and Macron are doing is anything other than making promises that they know that their successor's successor might have to deal with.
And why?
Because it's easy to say, because he's the hero of the hour. Zelensky, you're in Kyiv, you're with Zelensky. You don't mind putting a poke in the eye to Putin in a way that isn't actually going to cost you anything, because you're not actually sending heavy artillery or anything, you know, really useful, which is what Zelensky needs and wants. And instead, you're making a promise that won't be kept for decades.
Margaret, but that does suggest there's something different about Ukraine compared to much of the rest of the Warsaw Pact, which, of course, has now been integrated into the European Union.
Well, I like agreeing with Andrew often, but on this one, I don't want to agree. But I think I'm afraid he's right. And I've noticed in the rhetoric, you know, that the negotiations will be a long way in the future and they will take a long time. And we all know what that means. I think you're absolutely right.
See, I would argue that that's what NATO said in 2008, which opened the door to Russia moving into both Georgia and ultimately Ukraine.
So maybe it's a dangerous thing to say. You may well be right. And I think Andrew's right. They had to do something. You know, I think also memories of what happened when NATO expanded have made Western powers very leery of doing anything that will further stir the Russians up. Although at this point, difficult to see, you know, what else could be done that will make the right. I mean, would they behave any differently if Ukraine suddenly became a member of the EU? No, they probably wouldn't. But I think, you know, but the idea that Georgia, I think, was also mentioned as possibly becoming a member of the EU, and I think that's a long way down the road too, and in fact, probably never going to happen.
I mean, there's an interesting article in the Sunday Times by Dominic Lawson suggesting that when tested, as far as the outside world is concerned, Putin's bark is actually considerably less than his bite or his willingness to seriously cause problems.
And one of the things Dominic said in that, as you're right, very good article and pointed out, was that Putin actually didn't denounce the EU statement for Ukraine. In fact, he said, well, this is it's not a military organisation, the EU, so in fact, Russia doesn't see its...
Perhaps that was the message to Macron.
Well, it very much supports what Dominic was saying about his bark and his bite.
But if you wanted to be cynical, you could say that from Putin's point of view, if Ukraine is let into the EU, it's going to be a tremendous burden for the EU, because the EU will have to take, well, as it probably will anyway, take on responsibility for rebuilding it. And Russia will be able to, you know, absolve itself of any responsibility. If it's in the EU, it's the EU's responsibility.
Yes. It's going to take many billions in infrastructure rebuilding, isn't it?
But it seems to me they couldn't let it into the EU anyway as long as the Donbass is occupied, or indeed Crimea at the moment.
And there's always going to be one EU country that might oppose it.
Let's turn to how this all might end. Margaret McMillan, you've studied the end of other conflicts. How might this end, and should it be a priority to bring about an end to the bloodshed?
I think it should be a priority. I mean, what is happening in Ukraine is appalling, and it's taking a tremendous toll among those who are actually fighting. And as always in these sorts of wars, it's taking a tremendous toll among the civilians. I mean, the innocent bystanders who yet again have been caught up in it, killed, their buildings destroyed, their families torn apart. How many refugees now? 3 million refugees. I mean, it is a dreadful price that's being paid for this war, and I think we should all be thinking about how to end it. What often happens during wars is people are so focused on trying to win the war, they don't think enough about what happens afterwards and how you can come up with some sort of way of ending it. The trouble is also that for all the willingness, I think, of the West, and perhaps Zelensky would accept this, to try and find some sort of compromise, perhaps allowing, you know, accepting that Crimea has gone, for example, there's not any willingness, as far as I can see, on the Russian side to negotiate yet. And so it may take more fighting on the ground. It may take more attrition of Russian troops, possibly even Russian defeats, before the Russians will come around to saying, okay, let's make a deal. I don't know what Andrew thinks, but at the moment, I don't see much hope of any substantial talks.
No, I agree. And messy compromises are often the end of wars, and then they can last and last and last. Look at the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. You know, that's lasted for three quarters of a century. That was a messy compromise, but it was a compromise that came at the end of a very painful war. So I'm afraid I'm hugely bearish, like Margaret, about this.
There is talk, Margaret, of people citing Versailles and saying, and Macron, one of them, that it's very important not to humiliate Russia and Putin. What do you make of that? Which seems to imply leaning on Zelensky to make concessions. What do you make of that?
Well, Versailles is often used as an analogy of how things go wrong. It seems to me the Russians have already humiliated themselves. And how you somehow save Russian feelings, I think, is going to be a problem. And I think one thing that's important is to try, when peace finally comes, when the compromise is finally reached, to separate the Russian people from the Russian regime. It's important not to blame all Russians for the regime that has started this war, even though some of them, of course, do support it. But, you know, I think what matters once peace is made is how willing people are to try and make it work. And I've always thought, with the Treaty of Versailles, was that Germany signed at the end of the First World War, there was always the possibility of making it work. Germany had lost the war, after all, and it was made to feel that it had lost the war. It, for various reasons, or some of its political leadership for various reasons, chose not to accept that it had lost the war, and that became something that they used in German domestic politics. I still think peace could have been achieved. And if you look at what happened at the end of 1945, after the Second World War, talk about humiliating Germany, it was treated much more harshly than it was treated in 1919, divided, occupied, stripped of anything movable. And yet we don't hear talk about how the peace of 1945, the agreement arrangements of 1945, led to eventual Germany and never brought peace.
Is that old joke that General Mark Clark is supposed to have said about when his staff officers were complaining about the Carthaginian peace that was imposed on Germany at Versailles? And Mark Clark said, well, you don't hear much from those Carthaginians nowadays, do you?
Yeah, I've always thought that was very perceptive.
There was, though, the Marshall Plan of Reconstruction after 1945.
Yeah.
I think it's very important not to impose our settlement on Zelensky. I think that the French and Germans might well try that. I don't know when, but sometime in the future. I think that if we do that and the West does that, I don't think that...
Where do you think Biden would be on that?
I don't think he wants to do that. I think President Biden very much recognises that this has to be a Zelensky-led compromise peace if there is one. As very much does Boris Johnson. And I think that... So the fault lines actually could be the old ones of the Anglo-American on one side and continental Europeans on the other, over whether or not you pressurise Zelensky into some kind of a cobbled-together, maybe ignoble peace. And I really hope that we don't do that, because I don't think that peace is going to last. Whereas a peace that Zelensky does go into wholeheartedly and agree with, I think that's much more likely to last.
I think you're right, Andrew. And also, think of what was imposed on the Czechs in 1938 and how little that contributed to peace.
Yes, exactly right.
Andrew Roberts and Margaret McMillan there, talking about what history can tell us about the present war in Ukraine. This episode of Worldview for Engelsberg Ideas was funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for public benefit. The producer is Murray Jessel, assistant producer Eve Webster, and sound engineer Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton. Thanks for listening.